Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, welcome to Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. Today we're talking with our guest, Tommy Shelby, about how to think philosophically about Black identity. Like many people of my generation, I grew up watching The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, the show that made Will Smith a household name. In it, Will plays an African-American teen whose mother sends him across the country to live with his rich relatives because he got into, as the song goes, one little fight. The show advertises itself as a fish-out-of-water, rags-to-riches story, and in all fairness, it does spend a great deal of time focusing on these themes. But this is largely subterfuge. What the show really is a six-year exploration of what it means to be a Black male. Many of the show's jokes involve Will teasing Carlton, his rich cousin, for not being Black enough, culminating in the famous Carlton dance, the exuberant celebration of the music of uber-white Tom Jones. But the show also features Phil Banks, Carlton's father, a former dashiki-wearing activist-turned-judge who defends his own authenticity as a Black man while working within the system. Now, it is absolutely not my place to take sides on what it means to be Black. But it is noteworthy that part of what made The Fresh Prince unique is that it took this very controversy and put it in front and center for all of America, regardless of their race. Only 2 years earlier, in 1988, some Black critics objected to Spike Lee's movie School Days doing something similar, calling attention to a cultural preference for lighter skin in historically Black fraternities and sororities. They claimed that Lee was wrong to air out the Black community's dirty laundry for everyone else to see. Interestingly, The Fresh Prince and School Days were a radical contrast to The Cosby Show, which saw itself as modeling and legitimizing middle-class Black America with little attention to economic and cultural variation. There are at least two important premises underlying all of this. The first is that there is something that qualifies as authentically Black, that there is a right and wrong way to be African American. The second is that there is something called the Black community, that all Black people are a part of, and that whatever community it is that its members share, whatever commonality it is that these members share, it's unique to being Black. These are not unprecedented questions. Philosophy has long concerned itself with personal and cultural identity, from notions of citizenship to kinship criteria to self-image to moral obligations. Who we are and who we regard ourselves as being go a long way to define our experiences and expectations. As far back as the dawn of philosophy, people used the word barbarian to mean literally non-Greek. This allowed the Greeks to treat others more cruelly than they did their ethnic fellows. Jews, Christians, and Muslims all shared similar dichotomies at one point or another, as did various tribes and Europeans. American law and its de facto consequences are also rife with differing treatment, especially of whites and Blacks, even though the law strives to be colorblind. So Will and Carlton were asking questions that had roots in Aristotle, Leviticus, and papal law, questions that have no clear, settled answer, but nevertheless inspire many of us to act as if they are both resolved and certain. We analyze the preferences of Black and white voters, we racially profile, we live in largely segregated communities. One simply cannot understand the United States if one refuses to consider race as a relevant factor for analysis. The question before us then is, is any of this philosophically justifiable? Are there theoretical reasons to think of people as unified groups? And if so, do the way groups describe themselves have more authority than the way groups describe others outside their circles? Our guest today's first book, We Who Are Dark, is focused on just this, the philosophical foundations of Black solidarity. He'll help us navigate these complex and fraught questions. But I have something to add that's really important here. In the last 2 days, there have been two high-profile Black deaths at the hand of police, and what now appears to be a retaliatory ambush, killing five police officers. These are more needless deaths added to a string of others that have inspired Black Lives Matter activists and both Democratic primary candidates. Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, not to mention Trayvon Martin, Sandra Bland, Tamir Rice, Freddie Gray, and others were killed because they were Black, or maybe I should say that many people, including myself, are convinced that they wouldn't have been killed if they had been white. In other words, These identity questions are not just conceptual explorations. They have immense real-world repercussions, and this means that, in a certain respect, the traditional philosophical approach is turned on its head. We're not asking questions because they're interesting, hoping that the world will adjust to our conclusions. Instead, we're asking questions because we have to, because the world demands it. To help us through all of this, we turn to our guest. Tommy Shelby is the Caldwell Titcomb Professor of African and African American Studies and of Philosophy at Harvard University. He's the author of We Who Are Dark, The Philosophical Foundations of Black Solidarity, and the forthcoming book, Dark Ghettos, Injustice, Dissent, and Reform. Tommy, thank you for joining us on Why.
Nice to hear you, Jack. It's wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me.
We're pre-recording the show, so we can't take your questions live, but if you'd like, you can join our listeners in our chat room at whyradioshow.org, and you can always post on our Twitter feed at whyradioshow or on Facebook at facebook.com/whyradioshow. So, Tommy, I mentioned the violence of the last few days. Public response has been so emotional and so open, frankly. And so I have to ask you, does your work feel more urgent when you hear about these cases?
I suppose it does in some ways. They certainly remind me of the practical relevance of my work. They definitely motivate me to dig deeper for, you know, the truths that might shed some light on these kinds of problems. But I suppose my philosophical work tends to take the long view. I tend to, both backwards and forwards, I tend to look backwards toward, you know, slavery, its legacy, tracing its consequences to the present, but also tend to look forward, try to think about a future where black peoples are truly free and equal, which, you know, might be a long way off. And the kind of philosophy I do doesn't generally have sort of immediate practical application, since it doesn't prescribe very specific policies or marching orders for activists. It tries more to provide clear thinking, identify principles that might guide action, that sort of thing.
Is there, and we're going to talk about what this means in just a second, Africana philosophy, but is there an ivory tower for Africana philosophy? And I have to say, I've never really thought about the phrase before, but of course, ivory, right, comes from elephants, which are on the African continent. So there's a certain connection there just etymologically already. Can there be an ivory tower for these kind of questions?
Well, I think there is in the United States and elsewhere. The Academy has, had people engaged in philosophical thought, not all of them identifying themselves as philosophers or professional philosophers, but often they have. I mean, even in here at my own institution, Elaine Locke was, first PhD, black PhD in philosophy here at Harvard, and went on to start the philosophy department at Howard University, Historically Black College. So both in historically black colleges and in, we might go historically white colleges, there are is philosophical work on black issues and work in Africana philosophy and has been for some time now.
But there is something about Africana philosophy that is, I would say, inherently connected to the real world in a way that maybe analyzing Kant's transcendental deduction, right, might not be? Or am I misunderstanding the boundaries of the discourse?
No, you're right. I mean, I think that people who do what some people call Africana philosophy or what might be called black philosophy, maybe in a less euphemistic way, these are people who, they might take up traditional philosophical questions, but they usually do it in the context of thinking about, various aspects of black life. And they might draw on, say, very familiar canonical sources in Western philosophy or even non-Western philosophy, but they also tend to be engaged with debates that have been going on in the broader black intellectual tradition. And they sometimes draw on, vernacular sources like, black music and black folklore, the kind of debates you might hear in a black hair salon, a black barbershop. So it is sort of can be, grounded in everyday black communal practice, but also can be grounded in, thinking about, these big questions in philosophy that people have been thinking about for millennia.
So what then is Africana philosophy? And let me preface that question by asking, you said some people call it Africana philosophy. You call it less euphemistically Black philosophy. Is there a preference for one or the other? Is there an accepted preference for African-American versus Black, or is it generational? I know that Latino versus Chicano in the Latino community is very generational. Are these loaded terms, or are they just personal preference?
I think it's personal preference. I mean, I think Africana philosophy has kind of become a kind of designation within U.S. academic philosophy and to refer to work done by – sometimes done by Black people, but usually not just done by Black people, but taking up traditional questions of Black life, where Africana is meant to cover both work done by Black Africans, but also work done by people in the broader diaspora, whether in the U.S., or Canada or the Caribbean, sometimes even in Europe. So it's kind of a catch-all to capture a lot of philosophical work that's done by people of African descent here and elsewhere. Black, I suppose, when you put, Black in front of philosophy in that way, maybe it sounds, a little more militant. No, maybe a little bit more provocative when you put it that way. So maybe there's a kind of preference for Africana philosophy in that way because it seems maybe more academic and less sort of like loaded politically or less conjuring up ideas, say, from the Black Power era or something like that. But I tend to say Africana philosophy, but I'm, perfectly fine calling it Black philosophy too.
It's interesting that you use the word militant because, at least as I understand it, like with early feminist philosophy, Africana philosophy wasn't welcomed with open arms in the academy, right? There was suspicion. There was concerns. Is it hard to get this kind of philosophy accepted by mainstream traditional philosophers?
I suppose it is in some ways. Some of that maybe has to do with a dominant conception of philosophy as, say, standing outside of all intellectual traditions or as not circumscribed by time or place or as, the kind of thing that's sort of fully general in its answers about the human condition. And so maybe tying philosophical questions to a given people or set of peoples and their experiences might seem, at least to some people, as, say, insufficiently universal or timeless or general to count as a real philosophy.
So when we ask questions about what is a person to do, we're supposed to ask what all people are supposed to do, not what men are supposed to do or Black people are supposed to do or Chinese people are supposed to do. These should be universal questions.
Right. I think some people think of philosophy in that way, and that might lead them to be resistant to that idea. Not always, though. I mean, people do speak pretty freely about, the German philosophical tradition or French philosophy and so on and so forth. And so people, I think, do recognize there are different traditions for approaching philosophical questions. And some of the questions kind of arise from thinking about the particularity of the lives of those people in a certain place and time. So, I think there is that broader conception or dominant conception, I might say, that doesn't like to sort of see philosophy, tied to any people, place, or time in that way. But I think most people, when they reflect on it, they realize that philosophy is sort of connected to particular political traditions, and many of its questions do arise in particular moments, given certain things that may be happening at the time.
When we talk about things like Black identity and Black community, and we use these phrases that I introduced in the monologue and that we're going to be talking about for a significant part of the show, do these have direct connections to the Africana philosophers? Can we trace them back to Malcolm X, to Du Bois, to other folks who one might consider as part of this lineage?
Yes, I'd say definitely. I mean, lots of people have certainly in African American tradition and a broader Afro-Caribbean tradition, I certainly have been thinking about these issues of Black identity and Black solidarity for a very long time. In terms of, you know, written work that you might be able to kind of pore over, like philosophers like to do, you can see a lot of this traced back to, you know, the 19th century with, you know, figures like David Walker or, you know, Black nationalist figures like Martin Delaney or a figure like, you know, probably more dominant, well-known figure like Frederick Douglass. And so people have certainly been thinking about these questions for a long time and writing about them, even writing books about these sorts of questions. And I think for those of us who do Africana philosophy, we don't think of ourselves as just sort of just taking, you know, traditional philosophy, just kind of applying it to Black problems. I think we think of it as something that springs from a broader, longstanding tradition of Black thought that takes us back at least to slavery and encounter of Europeans with African peoples and European colonization. So we don't of Africa. So I think we certainly sort of see our work as rooted in a broader intellectual tradition, a set of debates, a set of ideas and sources, rather than just something that just sort of sprang up in the last, you know, 50 years or something like that.
So it's not like, well, all of this work in European philosophy has been done to create moral principles, and there's utilitarianism, and there's the categorical imperative, and there's the virtue ethics. Let's apply this to Black circumstances. Instead, it's not applied philosophy. It's its own branch of philosophy with its own discourse and its own history and its own discussion, although it may overlap at times.
Yeah, that's basically how I would describe it. I mean, not to say I don't want to say that there are some people who do Africana philosophy who may think of themselves as simply applying what they've learned from some more familiar Western philosophical tradition or doctrine to Black life. People do that. But I guess the way I understand it is something that is more than that. It also includes sort of respecting Black philosophical discourse and debates that have been happening for quite a long time, as you say, both independently and in conversation with the broader philosophical tradition.
So we have circumstances like we've had in the last few days. We've had circumstances like we've had in the last couple of years. And then we've had circumstances that we've had for half a millennia. Is there – I'm trying to figure out how to ask this question. Where do we start? Where do we look at Africana philosophy for some kind of, I don't want to say solace because I don't think philosophy provides solace, but rather some sort of analytic tool for us to have the ability to talk about what's going on without shouting at each other, without us hating each other, unless that's the appropriate response. Where do we start? What thread do we pull?
That's a hard question. I mean, I think in some ways it's hard to, without, you know, kind of contextualizing the question, if you're talking about a particular problem of racial injustice, you know, maybe these questions about, you know, what it means to be Black is not really the most relevant thing. But if we're interested in questions of, like, when we see Black people bound together and engaged in, you know, collective direct action, you know, hitting the streets, marching, and so on, you know, maybe that other kinds of tools might be appropriate. So it's hard. Maybe it's somewhat difficult to answer it in the abstract. Maybe we should focus it a little bit.
So are you suggesting that there are times when the question of Black identity is more of a red herring, that we use it? It's sometimes used to avoid the real issue? I'm thinking of some conservatives who will respond, well, President Obama isn't really Black. He's the product of a mixed marriage. And so his interest in racial injustice is artificial. That seems like, well, that's not an appropriate moment when we talk about Black identity. There are other sources in Africana philosophy, there are other threads to pull that will be more constructive.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tend to, when thinking about Black identity, I like to make a distinction between thin Blackness and thick Blackness. which I have found to help me in thinking through some of these issues. So when I talk about thin blackness, it's a kind of category within a sort of socially imposed classification scheme. Right? It's a familiar scheme we use to sort people into these categories of black, white, Asian, Native American, and so on. And the category sort of serves to mark off a set of individuals in say, in the U.S. on the basis of their having sort of sub-Saharan African ancestry and sharing certain visible inherited physical characteristics, you know, things like dark skin or tightly coiled hair or something like that. And so this thin blackness is a kind of mark, or it's a kind of salient social fact, right? And often it carries a certain social stigma. And so when thin blackness is the thing that's at issue, you know, a person can't really choose whether to be black or to stay black, right? I mean, it's a category that's just kind of applied to them. Thick blackness, on the other hand, is, I think of it as a kind of social identity, might be an ethnic or a cultural identity. And it's something that could be adopted or altered or lost even. It's often embraced as a kind of positive dimension of a person's self-concept. So thick black identities are generally components of a broader conception of human flourishing, you know, a conception of the fundamental aims or purposes of a good human life. And given a thick conception of blackness, it might make sense to, say, encourage somebody to stay black or to hold firmly to his or her black heritage, or someone's not really black or something like that. And it might be, you know, coherent, though I would say not always fully justified, to say that though someone, say, looks black or even just unambiguously looks black by our social criteria, that he or she is not, say, really black. If you're talking about thick blackness. But many of the issues that I think concern people, racial justice issues, have to do with thin blackness, that is, with how people are perceived and classified using familiar conventions for sorting people into these categories. And on the basis of that, people can be treated well or badly.
So thin blackness, how a person's familial history, a person's outward characteristics. This, certainly in the United States, has often been regarded as a negative trait. And one of the goals of the Black is Beautiful movement in the 1960s and early 1970s was to say, no, these physical traits are positive. They're wonderful. Malcolm X, or Alex Haley has Malcolm X write about this in his autobiography. Thick blackness is the cultural traditions and how one identifies what one wants out of life. And so this is, it sounds like you're suggesting that there is either formalized or informal notion of really life choices that is akin to even what, say, Aristotle would offer or a Catholic would offer, that this is how you see yourself, this is who your community is, this is what kind of choices you make. And so these two distinctions, one is maybe a fact of the matter, although it's socially constructed, and the other is a matter of choices?
Yeah, I think that's right. So I would say that the thin and thick distinction is meant to distinguish, say, the unchosen aspects of blackness from those dimensions that are at least somewhat subject to individual will. So the distinction's certainly not meant to deny that, say, the unchosen factors, whether biology or culture or something, are shape who we are. That's clearly the case. And not only are we sort of born into our race, many of us are sort of socialized into, you know, a kind of practice of cultural blackness from birth, if you like. And these facts about us, we can't change those facts. But of course, we can decide what significance we're going to attach to these facts. And in particular, I think we can choose whether to positively identify with and, say, affirm our blackness as a component of our self-conception, as our ongoing conscious practice. I think that's something that we can choose.
When we come back, we're going to dive deeper into this, and we're going to start talking about the question of black solidarity, what it means to be part of a community, and then make our way to your more recent book and talk about how social structures, ghettos, and other things interact with all these ideas. You're listening to Tommy Shelby and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this. Thank you.
the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussion of Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Tommy Shelby from Harvard University about Black identity and how to talk philosophically about this and other related topics. And I want to talk about a photo I have, and it's sort of hard and complex to do so for reasons that are not really worth getting into. When I was a kid, about 11 years old in sixth grade, I shared a room for about a year with a guy named Tony Jackson. He was about 40 years old. I always described him as a 7'5" black man, but he was probably about 6'5". Black ex-convict, was a drug counselor because he had been in jail for drug-related issues, and that's often what people do. And he passed away shortly after, and I loved him deeply, and I know he loved me. And I have a photo of him and his wife on my piano. And his wife's white, named Mary. And it's a weird photo because it's an older photo. It's very dark. And when you first look at the photo, you see Mary very distinctly. She's very, very white. But Tony, who was very dark-skinned, really fades into the background. And he, when you look at the photo for a while, you see him come out. You see him in his 1970s sunglasses and his 70s shorts. And it's a really important photo to me. But when I describe the photo, I have to describe it in those ways. And it makes me really uncomfortable. It makes me really uncomfortable because I'm describing it in language that recalls the minstrel tradition. It recalls the racist stereotypes and cartoons of black men being hidden in the dark and only seeing their eyes and their teeth. And it makes me uncomfortable, even though the photo is of great meaning to me and my history with Tony is great personal importance. And so, Tommy, I guess I tell the story because I want to ask you, we're having a deep and important conversation about an emotionally fraught issue. And you're a black man and I'm a white man, if you count Jews as white. And yet, I know that I'm going to say insensitive things, or I'm going to be sometimes perceived by some members of the audience as saying insensitive things, or I have to use language that is imperfect. How does the discourse change? How does the conversation change? Not because you're on a philosophy radio show, which of course changes things, but when the conversation involves different races, different histories, different traditions, and I don't even, you know, different sensitivity levels.
It certainly changes. I'm not sure that merely the difference between white and black, I mean, that has is a factor, but many other things are going to play into how the conversation will unfold, right? I mean, you mentioned things like, you know, sharing space with someone, intimate space with someone of another race is something that not a lot of white people do, and not a lot of black people do it either, you know, in terms of sharing that kind of intimate space, that kind of deep familiarity with white people on a kind of intimate basis where you really trust them and you open yourself up to them. But some do, and that'll make a difference to how a conversation unfolds. You know, obviously, you know, just having knowledge of sort of the history of race in America, of black people's experience here, makes a big difference to the kind of conversation that people can have. And I think it's one of the things that I always recommend that people do is, and it's hard in America, people don't like to, not that interested in American history, doesn't seem, but to spend some time reading that history. You know, I often suggest to people, even just reading some of the more famous black autobiographies, or give you a kind of feel of the texture of black life. And those go back from the slave narratives on up to more recent, more memoir sorts of works, like, you know, the kind of thing that Ta-Nehisi Coates done in his recent book. So I think there are lots of ways of bridging that gap, some of it by just finding more opportunities to interact with people of different races in less fraught spaces. And some of that just a matter of just gaining background knowledge, which I think can be gained through reading.
I have a very vivid experience of being in early high school, and I mentioned Malcolm X earlier because the autobiography of Malcolm X was profoundly important to me, both in terms of the ideas, but I remember, I have very, very vivid memories of being in that room reading that book and coming to the assassination scene and realizing that Malcolm X was killed four blocks from where I lived. And that made it real to me. Does the black philosophical tradition, does it connect? I'm trying to, again, figure out how to ask this question. Is there an element of real connections that one might not find in the most theoretical works? And I ask this in part because, again, feminism has been really adamant about inserting narratives in their philosophical work and personal connections and trying to minimize the authority of the disconnected voice, the God's eye view. Is there anything similar that in the tradition that we're talking about that allows people to connect the conceptual work with the actual practical experience?
I think so. I mean, a lot of people who work on these sorts of issues find themselves engaging black literature, black music, black drama, black autobiography, black film, and so on, partly because a lot of the philosophical reflection that's gone on in the black intellectual tradition has been engaged in those genres. And, of course, this is not unfamiliar in the broader Western philosophical tradition, which people do often write in different genres or use different media to get across philosophical ideas, including autobiography, but also dialogues, of course, in Plato, as we know, the fictional sorts of pieces, novels, and so on. So I think that's certainly true in Africana philosophy. People, say, prior to its kind of academic institutionalization, if you like, the mode of expression often took these other forms.
I know that one you co-edited a book on hip hop and philosophy, as well as your two single authored books. Is hip hop sophisticated enough to be a vehicle for philosophical exploration, and I would ask this of rock and roll and jazz, mm-hmm. and classical music as well, or is it an entryway, a gateway drug, so to speak, to philosophical ideas, which is often how I use these sorts of things on the radio show and on my blog? Is hip-hop part of the, or some hip-hop part of the Africana philosophical tradition, or are there distinct divisions in pop culture and conceptual, intellectual, academic work?
Well, I guess I tend not to – I mean, I'm a professional philosopher, so
right.
That's what I do. But I tend not to make a sharp distinction between the kind of everyday philosophizing that most people do, most people who are reflective about these kind of fundamental questions about human existence and life. That happened. A lot of people do this all the time. My 8-year-old daughter does it. So there is, and obviously there's a difference in sophistication from the professional who has the time to sit and really work out these things in great detail. And I talk to lots of people who have a lot of time on their hands to think through these things in great detail. But I wouldn't say it's merely sort of inspiration. I think people are actually engaged in philosophical reflection, grappling with philosophical questions in everyday life and in these other genres of expression apart from the philosophical essay or treatise. But there is certainly some difference in systematicity and precision and sophistication and background knowledge of what other people have done on those same questions. Those differences certainly are there. But I certainly have found it helpful in my own thinking, whether listening to hip-hop or reading a novel or seeing a good film. It has often helped me to think through things and given me ideas, different way of looking at things that maybe, you know, allowed me to make progress on the things that I've been reflecting on for some time now.
So part of what I've been trying to do in this episode so far is to give a overview or have you describe for us an overview of the tools that we use to ask these harder questions. And so let me then go directly to a particularly difficult question and ask about thick blackness and ask, okay, is there a clear idea of what it means to be black? What does it mean to be black in the thickest sense?
I don't think that, I mean, that people have answers. You know, I'm
right.
Not sure there's, it makes sense to think of there's being like one answer to that. I think that people will find different ways of being thickly black that are, you know, satisfying for them and perfectly defensible. And some of those ways might diverge from the way that other people do that. So I don't, the question, you know, what does it mean to be black in the thick sense, I don't think could possibly have one answer. That's not to say that some of the answers that people provide might not be confused or problematic or rooted in, you know, vicious sentiments and so on. I mean, that can happen too. So it's not to say that there aren't forms of thick blackness that, you know, should be criticized or rejected. It's just to say that I don't think that we should imagine that there's some one way of being black that everybody must conform to or else they're inauthentic or, you know, somehow self-hating.
Are there a few major answers that get the most attention? I'm thinking of saying Afrocentrism or black nationalism or attempts to assimilate. What are the main contenders?
That's a hard question. I mean, I'm not sure I would say that Afrocentrism is one of the main contenders. I mean, there are certainly people who I think have an Afrocentric worldview and orient themselves according to those ideals. But lots of other people, I think, you know, find, you know, meaning in ways that are not so, ways of being black that are not so tied to the black nationalist tradition. Most black people, if they've been raised in black communities and have a lot of interaction with black peoples or black institutions, will certainly be shaped in one way or another by black nationalist ideas or black Christian ideas or black Muslim ideas, because those ideas have been very influential and you know, circulate quite, you know, freely within black cultural practice. So most people are certainly familiar with those ways of orienting yourselves in the world and will have adopted certain pieces of those ways of looking at things. And they're going to be, you know, certainly if someone, you know, talked about being a black, you know, atheist, humanist, life would be a more marginal, if you like, way of being black in the world. But it's still a perfectly, I think, legitimate one.
So I'm going to ask a question inspired in part by Augustine's City of God, where for our listeners, Augustine argued that you are a city of you are a citizen of the city that you ultimately believe in. If you believe in God in the Christian way, that you were a member of the City of God and you could live next to a person who wasn't a Christian, and then you were a part of a different city even though you were geographically located. In black America, given the history of migration, of the Great Migration, of slavery, of economics, black communities tend to be densely connected and segregated. Is geographical location, therefore, an inadequate way to describe what makes a black community? Are there dozens of overlapping communities within a black neighborhood, say, that really have nothing to do with each other? It's just that politically we think of this neighborhood as black, or this, you know, this area as the black area, and that's an artificial imposed notion? Or is there something about living together in a segregated and often forced segregated way that means that the neighborhood is itself by definition a community?
That's a good question. I mean, I certainly, you know, for much of blacks' history in the United States, blacks have been kind of forced to live together in the same communities. Lots of, both by law, you know, because of the threat of violence if you don't. And that's something, so so for a long time, you know, the idea of a black community is sort of situated in space, that is, it's people being in the same, you know, neighborhood, community, living together, separated from whites. You know, by the late 60s, early 70s, this starts to change, partly due to the black freedom struggle and civil rights movement to open things up and cut down on discrimination in housing and opening up spaces for blacks to enter higher education and enter the professions. And so you have you know, sort of black professional class enabled to move and live where they want because they have the means to do so often, and are better able to get their rights respected than more disadvantaged blacks. So that change certainly I think affects the character of black communities in that they're. You don't have, all black classes sort of represented in the same neighborhoods. That's pretty rare to have that. What you have is a concentration of disadvantaged working class and poor blacks, usually in and around major cities in the U.S. And so, I guess one can sort of, you know, those are certainly black communities, and I think it would be a mistake to think that there is no black community beyond that. I do think there's a sense of black community that transcends neighborhood, and that is something that's shared even when people don't live in the same neighborhoods. But there's no question that has been transformed in some ways by the ways things have opened up in some ways for those who are able to take advantage of educational opportunities.
Could we use the terms thin and thick that you talked about in terms of black identity to apply here and say something like a place like Ferguson or a place like Detroit are thin black communities because that's just the geographical and the demographic structure, but a thick black community is a community of people with shared values who have shared outlooks and who really see their life and their living circumstances and their space as a shared project? Would that transfer those ideas?
I think so. I tend to make a distinction between black community and black solidarity. I don't think of them as quite the same, though they do overlap. I mean, as a sense of, you know, the idea of a black community doesn't necessarily have to be sort of politically loaded. People can enjoy living together because they share certain common experiences, they're comfortable with each other, they have certain cultural practices in common, their heritage might be such that it leads them to want to be together and treat that as a kind of common background knowledge in their interactions. And none of that needs to be motivated by any kind of political campaign. So I think of that as sort of black community. Black solidarity, I think, is different. I mean, it is political. It has to do with people making a joint commitment to each other to fight for some cause, usually in the case of blacks, to fight for justice for black people here and elsewhere. And I think that's black solidarity, I think, has a slightly different character, and there are different things I would say about that than I would say about the idea of black community.
So are there, and I'll steal from the title of your book, are there legitimate philosophical reasons. What are the philosophical foundations of Black solidarity? What justifies this connectedness other than the accidents of history and biology?
Maybe, let me take that and maybe in two parts. It might help just to say a little bit about kind of what I have in mind when I talk about solidarity. So maybe I should say something about that.
Sure.
So I tend to think of solidarity, this is quite general, right, as having, say, five core components. So on the one hand, there's a kind of mutual identification. So the group members, they kind of openly empathize with each other. They publicly identify with each other. Second, there's a kind of special concern, that is that these members are disposed to, say, come to each other's aid, right, especially the worst off in the group. And they might do that even when it calls for some kind of personal sacrifice. And then there are the sort of common values and goals, right? These are the set of values or objectives that are sort of widely shared in the group and generally known to be widely shared in the group. And fourth, there's loyalty. So the group members, they tend to, they stick by each other. They abstain from actions that are kind of undermine the group's basic aims, say. And finally, there's trust. The group members they're confident that others in the group, or at least a sufficient number of others, will do their part to defend the group's values and to advance the group's fundamental goals. So I think of those five elements as comprising a type of commitment, right? This is one that an individual can freely undertake or they can refuse to undertake or abstain from. It's a kind of pledge or vow, let's say, a way of sort of sincerely binding yourself to other people in a cause. And so once you've kind of made that pledge, it's fair then for others who have such solidarity to rightly hold you accountable for that commitment that you've undertaken. So I think of that as a, if you'd like, solidarity's general form, and that will be true for other forms of solidarity. You could give, I think, a similar analysis for solidarity in the working class or women and so on. And so I think all forms of group solidarity have those characteristics. When we're talking about, but then there are different types of solidarity, right? And here I think it's important to distinguish these different types by two things. One, the criteria, we've been talking about this already, the criteria that we use for determining membership in the group. And second, the specific values and goals that the members of the group are, say, jointly committing themselves to. And so we can think of those two things, criteria for group membership and the specific values and goals, as constituting the content of solidarity, and the five characteristics I gave before as describing its form. I don't know if that's helpful in framing things.
It is, because it helps us understand, I think, that that there's this general case of solidarity, but it also allows us to see all of the choices in solidarity. And I really like the notion of that with these choices then comes responsibility, then comes accountability. So I'm going to ask a leading question, and it's a leading question because I know you've done some work on this. There are some people who will say, okay, you see yourself in solidarity with other people in your community, with other African Americans, and yet you take welfare and you don't work. And that is a betrayal of that solidarity. Is there a moral obligation to the community, to the solidarity, to the community, to abide by this standard of work and to be the best you can be and be a go-getter and because, and we have to talk about this in a couple minutes, because economics and race is so intertwined, and because at least the perception of the Black community is that there's both significant unemployment and significant lack of personal responsibility, and I am not assenting to that premise being true. Though that criticism that people who are not working are betraying that solidarity, is that a fair criticism?
I think no. I mean, I think I often think back to work that Martin Luther King did in some of his later writings after the Voting Rights Act in 1965 was passed. You know, he tended to focus his work on what he called black slums or black ghettos. where unemployment tends to run very, very high and has now, you know, for some 50 years, run quite high. Some of that joblessness is, of course, involuntary, and something that King would emphasize is that some of this has to do with features of living in a society that organizes its economy in a capitalist way, that, you know, it is a tendency to keep labor costs down and to develop technology in a way that is you can increase productivity. And one byproduct of that is that often people find themselves either thrown out of work, unable to find work, or only able to find insecure work or temporary or part-time work. And, you know, that's a feature of life. So some people, some black people are going to be unemployed because of that. Some are going to be unemployed just because of racial discrimination, which continues in employment in the private labor market and is well documented. But some people, of course, might not be working because they're basically refusing to work. They're refusing to work because of the conditions under which they are expected to work, the kinds of jobs that are available to them, the type of pay that they're likely to get. They might refuse because of features of their situation. They might need to take care of their young children, and it might be difficult for them to do that adequately and also occupy the kinds of jobs that are available to them. So I don't think it's – I think it would be unfair to criticize a black person as not living up to black expectations or, being a good, comrade amongst black people if they're not working because of these involuntary sources of unemployment, but also because sometimes voluntary unemployment, choosing not to work, can be justified given the kinds of options that might be available.
Is there a reason to not work that is about personal values independent of choices? And I'll give you an example of what I mean. I was a guest speaker at a leadership class on another campus, and a student brought up this question of, basically what we're talking about now, which is people who are unemployed and not contributing to the community. And I was thinking of, again, Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, and also some of the characters in Harlem Shuffle and some other movies where they didn't have jobs, but they sat on the corner all day with each other, and they knew everyone in town on the block, and they watched, and they communicated, and they spread news, and their presence there was a kind of stability and a kind of social control. In some sense, might one say that these folks are actually contributing more to a community than leaving, working 55 hours a week, never being home, never talking to their neighbors? That capitalist model that you referred to, that Martin Luther King talks about, it presumes that labor is the best thing that you can contribute. But isn't there a place for people who are present in the community and who see their job as connecting people socially, even if it appears to be to not have labor and to not have productive value?
I think so. I mean, I think in the U.S., we tend to think of, work in the sense of making a positive contribution to society, that it completely depends on whether the market will reward your activity, right? But there are lots of forms of work, ways of contributing to the common good that the market won't pay, and we know this, right? We know that this because a lot of the work that's done in, caring for the young, caring for the old, caring for the infirm is done by women and is not paid and couldn't be more important. And some of the work I think that people could do are, maintaining stability in the community, as you suggest. Or there might be forms of work that the public sector should support because it would be good, for the society as a whole. So I think part of the trouble with the focus on people not working is that people feel the only measure of the value of their activity is whether they can earn a living doing it and earn a living by way of the market rewarding it. But there are many valuable things that worth doing that the market won't reward, and there are many things that the market will reward that is not worth doing.
Is it possible to detach economic injustice in the United States from racial injustice in the United States, or are they necessarily intertwined?
I think they're pretty tightly connected. I mean, I think it's clear that there are some economic injustices that affect people of all races, though they tend to affect blacks and Latinos sort of disproportionately. But they're clearly tied and been tied since the beginning of black people coming to this country as slaves, right? So the connection between, you know, race and economy, race and economic exploitation, race and economic disadvantage is pretty tight. And I don't think you can really make a lot of progress in thinking through the problems of race that we find ourselves dealing with unless we theorize these two things together.
I think again about the neighborhood I grew up in. I grew up in Washington Heights in upper Manhattan, which was the crack distribution center of the East Coast in the 1970s and 80s. And one of the there were a couple of reasons why this was the case. It was a Latino immigrant neighborhood, mostly Puerto Rican, Dominican, and Cuban. But it was infrastructurally, it's the one place in the East Coast where all of the major highways interact. I lived right almost below the George Washington Bridge, and all of the highways intersected, and so it became an outstanding place for drug trafficking, and actually sex trafficking, and so the oppression, the violence, the fear, the poverty, all had very, very specific economic connections, and people when they talk about Washington Heights, which is now a much better place to live, and they talk about ghettos, they tend not to talk about these causal effects. And so I guess the question which I was leading to was, do we have a healthy way of talking about ghettos? Do we have a when we talk about it economically, is it fair to the social aspects? When we talk about it socially, is it fair to the economic aspects? Are you satisfied with the way that the public discourse thinks about, talks about, and argues about the existence and the way we should respond the ghettoization of people?
No, not really at all. I mean, I think that people tend to moralize about the behavior of disadvantaged black people concentrated in and around our cities, focusing on what are perceived as their irresponsibility or imprudence. And I think that if you just focus on if that's the only way you can frame things, and you're not even beginning to understand what's at the heart of black disadvantage in these sorts of places. And I think that even extends to some of the work that people in the social science and social policy community. I mean, I think even there is a tendency to not fully see black people as agents, as moral and political agents, as making decisions about how they're going to respond to injustice, as reflecting on what's an appropriate response to their condition. And I think when you frame things that way, there's a tendency to be, you know, either paternalistic or punitive. And that's basically what we've seen, you know, since the 60s, when the ghetto becomes kind of a topic of, you know, public discourse and in law and policy, and that there are numerous books written on that. You know, so for, you know, for 50 years, I think we've been discussing these questions of the ghetto either in a highly moralistic way or in a way that's rooted in a scientific study of social structure, but that doesn't really fully appreciate or capture the ways in which, you know, in some ways, that the ghetto denizens we're talking about, their philosophical orientation to their condition, right? That is their reflection on what they're up against, what's a dignified way of responding to that, when it's appropriate to dissent, what forms of dissent are justified given the circumstances that you're facing. You don't get a lot of careful, serious analysis of that, even, I think, in the social science and policy community.
as an example of sort of the way that we moralize and ignore the dignified nature of responses, I'm thinking about there's been a change in tone about protests in the last 15 years or so, maybe 20, that protests are now referred to first and foremost as peaceful protests. And the implication there is that most protests are either on the verge of violence or are violent, and that you have to remember that this is a dangerous circumstance and that it can blow at any time, but these people were the good people and they were peaceful. Instead of just calling it protests and then calling a violent circumstance something else, a riot or even just a violent protest, making the norm the nonviolent. Are there other examples of ways that we unconsciously or perhaps consciously for some people poison the well when we talk about otherwise dignified responses to injustice in the ghetto?
Yes. I mean, to try to be charitable, I mean, I think to some of these responses, I mean, one of the things you see, say, to return to King for a moment, you know, King writes about the Watts riot in 65 and, you know, and there were subsequent riots that happened before he died and, of course, numerous ones after he was assassinated. And so, you know, these things are familiar to people and scary to people and some scary to some black people that you can have a very combustible situation where people are deeply disadvantaged, feel unjustly disadvantaged, are frustrated with the rate of progress, feel frustrated by the way they're treated by public officials, particularly the police, but not only them. They feel like they don't have a voice. They can't be heard. We know that under these kinds of conditions, violence can erupt. That's not a figment of people's imagination. It can happen. So I think that's something that's to be on guard about. But I'd say also when it comes to peaceful protests, you know, those can take different forms too. I mean, one of the things that I think King was pushing for toward the end of his life was ways of using nonviolent direct action in ghetto communities to try to make progress, forms of civil disobedience, you know, breaking public order regulations in order to draw attention to injustice, being willing to go to jail to draw attention to the serious injustices that are happening in these communities, using economic pressure, boycotts. Operation Breadbasket was one thing where you could target, you know, corporations, businesses that, say, are refusing to hire black people or treating them badly or otherwise exploiting black communities. You can target them for boycott in order to get some kind of relief, to get them to change course. So there are forms of political protests that are nonviolent, but that can be aggressive, that can be militant, uncompromising, that can make people uncomfortable. And I think that could be effective. So I think there's a lot of space between, you know, a riot and what some people I think of as a kind of peaceful march where people just sing and hold up signs.
You know, it's funny. This is the second time in our conversation, at least, that you've used the term militant. And when I was much younger and an activist, I probably thought positively about that term. But then I really forgot about it for a long time. I don't want to say I thought negatively. I just didn't really think about it. But it's a tremendously useful term. And it's, I think, very positive in a lot of respects. Would you talk a little bit more about this idea of what makes something militant and why a militant response to something might be a positive response?
Sure, I'll try. I mean, when I say militant, I really just mean maybe a couple things. One, that, you know, an insistence on change now, is one thing King's always pointed out, the time for justice is always now, rather than this sort of focus on incremental, things will eventually work themselves out kind of thing, right? You know, things must change now. You have gross, serious injustices that are burdening people. Those things should be addressed now. We shouldn't have to wait. And also a kind of uncompromising spirit of sort of unwillingness to just kind of give in to injustice, to submit to it, to just kind of take what you can get, but rather just insisting on what you take justice to really require. And that might mean, to add a third thing, it might mean that, you know, tactically you will have to do things that some people will regard as outside the bounds of legitimate political activity, right? Doesn't necessarily mean that you're calling for a violent response, but it might mean being very aggressive in the things that you do in order to draw attention to the things that matter. Again, pointing to things like disrupting events, pointing to things like using language, films that are provocative and that kind of shake people up and make them give them a certain amount of discomfort. Boycotts that put economic pressure on. I mean, doing things that are aggressive and not just sort of merely symbolically vocalizing your dissent and expressing your displeasure, but using tactics that that might, at least in some people's eyes, seem unacceptable.
Aren't the standards of what constitutes aggressive, though racialized in themselves, and the bar for aggressive for someone who is black is much lower? I'm thinking both of Beyoncé and the performance she did at the Super Bowl last year, which was, you know, non-threatening in any bodily sense, just a work of art. But the reaction was so vehement against it that Saturday Night Live even made fun of it by creating a fake movie trailer called "The Day Beyoncé Turned Black," and then the whole analysis of President Obama's demeanor and how many political analysts would say things like he has to avoid looking like the angry black man, and that set of emotions is not available for him. So isn't even the term aggressive itself loaded and hard to pin down?
No, you're certainly right. I mean, I do think that many people are put off by any form of black self-assertion. And so there are and has been for some time that, you know, a sense of the good black, what it is to be a good black person. A person doesn't make trouble. They fit in. They don't speak out. When injustice occurs, they basically just follow norms and expectations. And people who step outside of that, and it may not be stepping very far, as you point out, are often seen as troublemakers, as problematic, as people who need to be put in their place and constrained.
Right. Henry Louis Gates, your colleague at Harvard, was stepped out of that bounds when he was unlocking his door because he was wearing a backpack coming back from a trip, right, that led to the famous coffee summit in the beginning of the Obama administration. The permissible semiotics, let alone clothing they wear and people wear and all that kind of stuff, that itself is incredibly narrow, right?
That's right. I mean, we saw that with controversy around Trayvon Martin and the idea of the hoodie as something, well, at least when black people wear a hoodie, lots of other people wear hoodies all the time and doesn't seem to be a problem. But when black people, especially black men and black boys, wear hoodies, it can be seen as threatening in itself, right? You know, clothing styles that are, you know, in many cases just a matter of fashion, right, and making a statement. Right. And black people have a long tradition of using clothing and fashion as a way of expressing themselves and, you know, creating beauty in the world as they see it. And some of that can be seen as aggressive and transgressive, just styling your hair, in a what people call a, you know, natural hairstyle, rather right. than, say, straightening it in some way or putting it in a way that resembles the way that, say, white people wear their hair. That can be seen as threatening. So it's true. Now, these things, of course, can be turned to good use in the sense that they are, you know, the willingness to perform these, if you like, modes of unacceptable blackness, can be ways of signaling to other black people of that, as we like to say, you're down for the cause, that you are a person to be trusted in a collective struggle that we're engaged in to try to bring about justice here and elsewhere for our people. So sometimes those modes of expressions, you know, signal something important. Sometimes they're meant to register, public political dissent. And one could take advantage of the fact that you're stepping outside, you know, what's acceptable, stepping outside your place as a mode of political protest. Though sometimes it's just because it's beautiful.
Right. And I accept that, right? And this is one of the – we don't have to have this conversation, but this is one of the deep philosophical questions in things like cultural appropriation, right? If a Caucasian person is going to wear a dashiki because it's beautiful, are they transgressing in some negative way? I don't want to open that can of worms. I think to a certain extent we've gone full circle, right, in the sense that when we first started talking, we talked about Africana philosophy and its place in the philosophical tradition and its acceptance or rejection by, we'll say, the more conservative or traditional elements of philosophy. We were having the same conversation, weren't we? The unacceptable blackness extended to unacceptable black philosophy. And so in a certain sense, part of what your work is doing is not just analyzing the freedoms that African-Americans should have and what the best we can do in what a non-ideal society, but also reasserting that blackness in philosophy itself. Isn't that right?
That's correct. I certainly have, you know, tried in my own work to do just that. I'm as interested in traditional philosophical questions as many philosophers, but I've certainly been trying to push the boundaries to, you know, I write about black thinkers, which is something that, you know, a lot of philosophers don't do, really. All through my training in graduate school, I was never assigned a single text by a black writer, you know, in all my time in graduate school. So I try to change that. I will teach courses on Du Bois, or I'll teach a course on Richard Wright, or I'll teach a course on black nationalism and things of that sort to bring those sources into the conversation, to bring those debates into the conversation. You know, I might write something about hip-hop or engage aspects of vernacular culture in order to show that the black people in their everyday lives are engaged in philosophical reflection and that those voices are worth hearing as well. So it's certainly a part of, you know, if you like, a mode of thick blackness for me to make these choices, and in the kinds of things that I work on and the ways I write about them and what I tend to emphasize in my work.
So let me ask one last question. It's a little bit of an inside baseball question, but I think that all of our listeners will understand the connection to the conversation. When I teach political philosophy, particularly contemporary political philosophy, I'll include, for example, Charles Mills, who's a black contemporary political philosopher who works in the social contract tradition. But if I'm teaching a philosophy 101 class and I want to bring in some black voices and I bring in, let's say, Frederick Douglass, or as many anthologies do, Martin Luther King's Letter from Birmingham Jail. How do I know the line between wanting to be inclusive and tokenism? How do I know, as a responsible teacher and as someone who supports pretty much every idea of racial justice, whatever I conceive that to be, how do I know when I'm really including voices in a constructive fashion and when I'm fetishizing or making someone a token? And I guess to enlarge that to people who don't have to teach intro to philosophy, we all know that the television show that has the one black character out of 50, or the one Asian character, or the one female character, and that there's a sense on university pamphlets where, you know, every picture is a multicultural ideal, regardless of what the the current student makeup is here at UND. We struggle with that. Where's the line between experimenting with inclusion and having a token choice to make myself feel better or take the easy way out?
That's a hard one. I mean, you know, when it comes to a syllabus, you can only put so many things, right? So
right.
It depends on what you're doing. I mean, and so there's a way in which everything is kind of token representation. And in many syllabi, we find ourselves putting a little bit of this and a little bit of that to introduce students to things that we know there's a lot, so much more. So I often recommend to people that part of what you do is even though you can only teach, you know, this one essay or something like that in your class, given other things you're trying to cover, that doesn't mean that's all you read. I mean, you may know, right. You know, take the time to read a lot more about the figure. I often feel that way about Du Bois. I mean, Du Bois wrote was a speech, became an essay, The Conservation of Races in 1897. Became kind of famous partly because of the debate that sprung up, that the philosopher Kwame Anthony Appiah sort of started in the 80s. And
he was actually a guest on the show with a wonderful episode.
Oh,
so
great.
Our listeners know him.
I'm quite fond of him. He had a big impact on me and my philosophical development. And that essay of his on Du Bois and the conservation of races became very influential in academic philosophy. Lots of people wrote responses to it. But I think what I often feel like people, when they think about Du Bois as a thinker, you know, they tend to limit themselves to, say, reading that essay and maybe reading some part of The Souls of Black Folk. But, of course, even The Souls of Black Folk, published in 1903, I mean, you know, Du Bois lived 60 more years.
Right.
And wrote tons and tons of books and all kinds of essays and wrote in pretty much every conceivable genre and had a very philosophical cast of mind, was an undergraduate philosophy major here at Harvard and, you know, studied with William James and others here. And I think it's one thing that one can do is spend some time with some of those other writings. And so in the context of teaching, say, that token piece, you can bring out the many other things they have to contribute, other ways in which they are engaged in the great discussion that we call philosophy. And in that way, at least from the standpoint of feeling like you're doing this in good faith, you know, you're showing that you're really taking the thinker seriously and willing to spend some time in their mind by carefully reading more of their corpus.
And I think that's a wonderful place to end the conversation, because I think we can extend that notion of good faith to most of our race-oriented thoughts and discussions and in general what it's like to deal with otherness. Take that mind seriously. Try to spend some time in that person's mind and try to think of them, excuse me, holistically, as opposed to just this one tiny slice that you interact with. Tommy Shelby, thank you so much for joining us on what could have been a very, very difficult, fraught conversation, but was wonderful and accessible and really instructive for me, and I'm sure for our listeners as well.
Thanks so much for having me, Jack. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Tommy Shelby and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Y Radio store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We were talking with Tommy Shelby, asking the question, how do we talk philosophically about Black identity? A fraught topic, a complicated topic, a sensitive topic, and one that, of course, I approached with particular care because I don't want to offend anybody. And it's funny because philosophy itself, in some senses, is inherently offensive. We're forcing people to ask questions and to consider things that they take for granted. And bring race into the equation, and it becomes more complicated. We saw that. We saw that with the early reception to Africana philosophy, the notion that black thinkers are not necessarily part of the discussion in philosophy, and that the world is forcing us, I think happily, that we're being forced to think about it, although the circumstances in which we're forced are awful. And so when we ask about black identity in Africana philosophy, we start to get a nuanced, more philosophical view. We have this notion of thin identity, which is the identity that's pushed upon you by your history and by your skin color. And then you have thick identity, which is the choices that you make, the values that you espouse, the connections that you hold, the loyalties that you are committed to. And when we talk about black identity in this country, we so rarely talk about the second. We only talk about the first. But that's not fair, because it doesn't treat African Americans like whole people. It only takes the African American as someone whose identity is foisted on them by circumstance and by biological and historical accident, and not by the choices that they make, the learning that they've engaged in, the experiences that they've had, the love, the sharing, the anger, the frustrations, the full range of human emotions, because it is still radical to suggest that people of every color and every race are equally human. Philosophy has denied it. Politics have denied it. And the violent incidences of the last few days certainly have denied it. Philosophy allows us to see that there's nothing wrong with being militant, that sometimes being militant is a necessary and a moral response, because you don't want to wait for change. Sometimes change has to happen. So the notion of community, the notion of solidarity, these are all philosophical ideas that are built on this notion of identity. And until we take black identity with the seriousness that it deserves, we can't have a full conversation. This is an urgent issue. This is a question not just of intellectual interest. It is a question of justice. And I am tremendously grateful that Tommy Shelby was here to share these ideas with us and to show us with such clarity where we have to go from here. You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.